Welcome to Your Health, a podcast brought to you by the Health Desk here at NPR. I'm Rebecca Davis. In this week's program, Thinking Positive to Prevent Depression in Adolescents, two new studies on obesity show it's leveling off. Is LASIK eye surgery all it's cracked up to be? And just how much worry can Army wives possibly take? But first, Allison Aubrey continues her occasional series on small changes that can make a big difference in health. This time, she focuses on teaching emotional resilience to middle schoolers as a way to prevent depression.
I want to begin my story with a man who told me that it took him 45 years to learn what he might have been taught in sixth grade. John Kelly told me that the mind is a funny thing. He wonders how many of us have caught ourselves thinking, ugh, how could I be so stupid? Or, ugh, this will never work out. It's something he certainly did a lot of.
Absolutely. And my childhood was riddled with those thoughts. And you believe the things your mind tells you.
7 or so years ago, Kelly hit a rough spot. His father was in a nursing home, very sick, and he was facing a malpractice suit in his orthopedic practice.
In retrospect, I did nothing wrong. At the time, you believe, boy, maybe I'm not so good, and the thoughts start, arising, and you buy into it, and you get this negative spiral. So I was really down.
When Kelly reached out for help to a therapist at the Beck Institute in Philadelphia, it had never dawned on him that he could see these bad circumstances any differently. His guilty thoughts were telling him that he was a terrible son, not seeing his dad enough, and a terrible doctor. But in a few months of therapy, he learned something new. He learned to play detective with his own thoughts, to look for evidence as to whether they were true.
I was world champ at all or nothing thinking. Like if one surgery didn't go well, then I was no good surgeon. That's a common distortion that our mind plays on us. And after writing, my thoughts down and looking at them, writing what I thought was a more realistic interpretation, after a while, you start really truly recognizing that they were false.
Kelly says realizing this was a game changer. With more realistic thinking, his emotions changed too.
You'd often get immediate relief looking at the thoughts right away on paper and saying, this is crazy. I don't know why I'm thinking these things.
When I asked Kelly if he wished he'd known how to use these strategies earlier in life.
Oh my gosh, without question. I look at all the years that I suffered needlessly. What you learn is you rewire your brain.
What studies show is that there are lots of John Kellys out there. And when they learn to check their negative thoughts against the facts and cope with stress, it can be as effective as taking antidepressant medicines. The evidence is quite strong.
If you're in the gym line, can you show me who's ready?
Now, where the story goes from here may sound like a leap, so stay with me. I've moved on to a school, and I'm standing outside the fifth grade classrooms, a good place to explain that the latest research shows you can introduce the same techniques that John Kelly learned during one-on-one therapy to groups of 10-year-olds in a classroom.
Listen, 10-year-olds are very good lawyers.
Tom Brunzel, dean at the Kip Infinity Charter School in Harlem, says these kids are really ready for this emotional health 101 kind of class.
They're constantly looking for fairness in the world, and they're spotting unfairness in the world.
Brunzel says it does no good just to say buck up or get over it. This is the age you can begin to show kids how to take control of their negative thoughts.
So, we are going to talk about how your self-talk, the things you tell yourself, your thoughts, can lead you to different feelings when disappointing things happen.
Brunzel hands each kid a copy of the same cartoon strip, and he describes the picture in the first panel.
You're going to see an angry coach talking to the players, to the team.
The coach is pointing to a 0 score and looking down on the players as if to say,
this team did a terrible job today. When are we going to do better in practice?
In the second panel, there's one boy, a player on the team, standing next to the coach. The thought bubble over his head is blank. The kid's job is to fill it in. What must this kid be thinking? Brunzel tells them to jot it down.
Then write an arrow to the feeling that you think is connected to this belief. Okay? Go.
As they picked up their pencils and began writing, I found myself wondering, is there really more than one way the kids will see the situation? As the mom of a boy this age, I've got pretty good insights into the 10-year-old brain. Turns out the answer is yes.
Okay, so I see people are almost finished.
Alicia Echeverria shares first.
What I wrote in my thought bubble was, why is he so mean? His screaming makes me want to cry. I think I have a tear.
Alicia says the coach's anger feels like a personal attack, so she draws an arrow to sadness. If this happened to Alicia, sounds as if she'd really be down.
Okay, looks like Anthony's ready. Anthony, why don't you share?
Anthony Ortiz's self-talk is a downer, too.
Man, we lost. We let the coach down. We're the worst team ever.
Another example of a kid taking it on himself and feeling bad. But here's a third interpretation.
What I wrote in my thought bubble was, I won't be mad next time. I will be better. The coach can be mad. So what? I'll do better next time.
So Bryce Marcus's player wasn't sad or angry. He actually felt okay. He realized the situation wasn't permanent. So here we have three kids, three different internal dialogues, each leading to a different emotional reaction.
So what I want you to understand here is that, yes, the coach is being very negative in this cartoon, but you have a lot more control over your feelings than you think. And if you focus your self-talk on really feeling, you know, better about the next time, you're going to have a better shot at winning that game.
The kids nod their heads. They seem to get it. But can they actually put it to practice in real life? Anthony Ortiz says it's tough. Take just the other day when he missed what he says was an easy problem on a math test.
You just think that you're stupid automatically. That's the first thought that comes into your mind, but you have to try to, like, fight that away.
He learned to stop and think about the real facts. Overall, his math grade is pretty good. And then there's Bryce Marcus. He says he's trying to use what he's learned.
It's come in handy here sometimes when I get mad.
A few weeks ago, he said he was furious with his sister when he came home from school and found his video game broken on the floor. But before he started a fight, he stopped to find out the facts. Turns out it was an accident.
I went into the bathroom and I looked in the mirror and I was like, when I was trying to calm down with facial expressions.
So is stepping back from a highly emotional reaction a sign that Bryce is learning to be more emotionally resilient?
Absolutely. I think that's a wonderful example. And that's really what we hope for, is that kids will internalize the skills enough that they can use them in the moment.
That's Jane Gillum, a lead researcher of resilience training. She says there are now more than a dozen published studies, all showing benefits.
Well, I'm a skeptic. I'm a scientist and a skeptic, so it took a lot for me. But the evidence is starting to accumulate now that these skills can prevent the onset of depression and that they have powerful effects.
None of this implies that resilience skills are some kind of magic bullet. Clearly, there are genes and life events that put some folks at higher risk. Take, for example, 17-year-old Victoria Fornitero. Clinical depression runs in her family, and she started struggling early in high school.
I didn't have much energy. I wasn't sleeping at night.
After her primary care doc at Kaiser Permanente flagged it, she ended up in cognitive therapy, learning the same strategies John Kelly and the fifth graders learned. At the time, she was hanging out with a group of girls who were bringing her down.
And just mean, petty things being said and done.
And she internalized all of it.
And you start thinking, well, you know, maybe because of all these people don't like me, other people aren't going to like me, it's all me.
But after learning to check her thoughts and to look for evidence, she realized she was very likable and liked around another set of friends, so she chose to start spending more time with them. Researcher Greg Clark says there's evidence that teens like Fornitero are being helped by these strategies.
If we can make a difference and change the trajectory at that early point, then we might see, we hope it will see, a better life outcomes for these teenagers that will extend in many ways.
Not just in the teen years, but perhaps over a whole lifetime. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
The obesity epidemic in America appears to be at a plateau. Two recent studies show that decades-long increases in the number of obese and overweight Americans has leveled off, except for one group. Boys aged 6 to 19 are still getting bigger, especially the heaviest boys. Deborah Amos talks with Dr. Anjali Jain, a Washington, D.C. pediatrician and obesity researcher.
Good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
What we're going to look at is a paper published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and it seems to suggest that we are reaching a plateau, but not the end of the problem. Is it slowing?
It's hard to say for sure because of the numbers make it difficult to assess long-term trends. But there are hopeful signs, yes.
But the worrying part is boys between the age of 6 to 19, especially those who are already overweight.
Mm-hmm.
Why are they bucking the trend?
Actually, as the obesity epidemic has come on, part of what's happened is not only has everyone been getting a little bit heavier or fatter, if you want to say that, but the heaviest kids have been getting disproportionately fatter. What is different this time is that we're seeing the lack of a plateau in that group.
And why that particular group? What is it about those boys, 6 to 19?
Well, we don't know exactly, and we don't know why. It could be that they just haven't reached that plateau yet, that girls reached earlier. That's some of the thinking.
And when you talk about this particular group
that
appears to be at risk, what are you talking about in terms of obesity, in terms of weight?
Okay, so if you take, let's say, a 12-year-old boy that's about 5 feet tall, an absolutely ideal weight for a boy that height at that age would be around 91 pounds. So relatively skinny, if you think about it. A kid who was overweight would be more like in the 120 range. And so a kid that's at the 97th percentile, beyond obese, really, would weigh around 133 pounds.
Are there long-term health risks for a 6 to 19-year-old who is already 40 pounds overweight at that age?
Absolutely, there are. I mean, there cannot even be immediate risk. About half of kids who are obese will have one other complication, as in hypertension. Often they have orthopedic problems, asthma, a lot of other complications. Most kids who are obese as children become obese adults. And once you get to those heaviest sizes, like above the 97th percentile, the risk of complications just goes up exponentially.
When you see a study like this that singles out a particular group, you're a pediatrician, you see kids, and does that make you think, okay, I really now have to do something?
I've been feeling that the alarm bells have been going off for quite some time. And luckily, childhood obesity is getting a lot more attention and a lot more funding than it used to, because a lot of experts have predicted that children's lifespans today are going to be shorter than that of their parents.
That's a pretty shocking statement.
That's what people have predicted, if it continues at the current rate.
So knowing you have a boy at risk between the ages of 6 and 19, would you say to a parent, you really do have to go talk to your pediatrician?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, talk to a pediatrician, talk to their parents, the family. I mean, really, the whole family's lifestyle has to change. It never works to only have something that one child does and nobody else is doing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now a closer look at LASIK. More and more patients are complaining that there are side effects to the surgery, so the Food and Drug Administration is investigating. And NPR's Patty Namond has more.
During LASIK eye surgery, doctors use a laser to vaporize portions of the cornea, reshaping it for better vision. It's a relatively quick, simple outpatient procedure, but for some patients, the end result is not what they expected. Dr. Malvina Edelman is with the FDA.
They were reporting symptoms such as dry eyes, glare, starbursts, and double vision, which was significantly affecting their quality of life.
Take Paula Kofer, for example, who had LASIK in 2000.
The first thing I noticed was that my right eye was very blurry. My left eye seemed pretty good in the daylight, but both eyes were very distorted at night, and I developed severe, persistent dry eyes.
Which may not sound like a big problem, says Kofer, but make no mistake, she says, it's huge.
For me, it's severe, constant burning. My eyes burn all the time.
They're painful and require constant attention. Eye drops, eye rinses, eyelid scrubs, a mask at night to keep dry air away from her eyes. She's had her tear ducts plugged to keep tears from draining away. And finally, there's the moisture-retaining goggles.
I look like a fly. They're very unattractive. I hate to wear them because they're so unattractive, but...
They work. So Kofer wears them inside where fans create lots of dry air, like at the gym, and she wears them outside when air is dry, like on a windy day. Kofer also suffers halos and glare at night.
I can't see. If I drive a car at night, my vision is totally impaired. I'm not safe to drive. I can't see pedestrians on the side of the road.
And the coup de grace? Kofor still needs glasses and contacts. Bottom line, she was simply not a good candidate for LASIK. Her large pupils make laser correction difficult, and for some reason she's prone to severe dry eye. But she says no one told her about these potential problems. The FDA's Edelman says the agency has stepped up its efforts to ensure doctors provide patients with information about risks and precautions before having LASIK. That includes things like large pupils, thin corneas, and undiagnosed dry eye. Edelman says the agency's also looking into misleading claims.
You can't, for example, promise vision free of glasses. Patients need to make sure that they understand, even in the perfect case scenario, if they don't need glasses for distance vision, there's a very high likelihood that they will need reading glasses. So something like spectacle-free existence is obviously a misleading claim.
And so is a guarantee of 20/20 vision. The FDA has also begun a study which will include thousands of LASIK patients nationwide to figure out just how many suffer severe complications and why. The hope is to better predict good candidates for LASIK. Dr. Sanjay Patel is a researcher and specialist in corneal surgery at the Mayo Clinic. He says the study findings will be helpful.
Right now, we do not have good data to actually give patients a percentage to say there's an X percent chance that you're going to have dry eyes after refractive surgery. There are no good large data series that give us those numbers.
The FDA hopes to complete its study by 2012. In the meantime, Dr. Marguerite McDonald, who practices in New York and is spokesperson for the American Academy of Ophthalmology, says recent advances should help complications like dry eye.
10 years ago, it was treatable, but we didn't have as many things in our bag of tricks. Now we have a lot of things that can treat dry eye. They say never, but I have personally not encountered someone who couldn't be treated very successfully.
There have been advances in laser technology too, says McDonald, which have decreased the risk of nighttime halos and glare.
Wavefront guided LASIK allows us to measure thousands and thousands of data points that define the optical pathway in each eye. That can now be measured, and small aberrations can be fixed.
The FDA says it's encouraging patients to report any severe problems with LASIK, not only to the doctor who performed the surgery, but to the federal agency as well. Patty Namond, NPR News.
Scientists have studied troops coming back from wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and found high levels of mental health problems. Now researchers are starting to look at their families. NPR's Joseph Shapiro reports on a study of mental health problems among Army wives.
The report in the New England Journal of Medicine finds that Army wives report a lot of stress when their husbands are sent to Afghanistan and Iraq. And the longer the deployment, the more likely the wife is to experience depression, anxiety, trouble sleeping, and other mental health problems. That deployment creates stress shouldn't come as a surprise. Still, the study's welcome news for Army wives like Kelly Lohman of Fayetteville, North Carolina.
There's no surprise, but it seems to be surprising to the wives themselves, especially newly married spouses or spouses that have not experienced a deployment before. You will have a sense of worry like you've never felt before.
There's more worry when troops face second, third, fourth deployments and more. Over just 3 years, Kelly Lohman's husband, James, was sent to Afghanistan twice and then to Iraq.
It's a continuing stress. We are a constant ready force, so you may exchange the distress of he's leaving for the stress of he's gone, to the excitement that he's coming home, to the stress of he's going to leave again in 12 months.
And after her husband, a helicopter pilot, was severely injured, there's been even more stress. She followed him to hospitals from the East Coast to the West, leaving their young daughter with friends and family. There was stress as James fought for his life, and still today as he deals with traumatic brain injury and PTSD. Kelly Lohman sought help from her Army doctor at Fort Bragg.
I actually just walked into the clinic in tears one day, and I just explained that I was having anxiety, I was having panic attacks. And I was handed three prescriptions, one for something to sleep, something for anxiety, something for depression, but there was no support. It was just, take these, you'll feel better.
Only later did she get free counseling from a sympathetic local therapist, then support from other Army wives and advice on how to cope from the Wounded Warrior Project, a group that now employs Lohman to seek out other troubled Army wives. Alyssa Mansfield at RTI International is the co-author of the study that showed widespread mental health problems among wives whose husbands are sent to war.
What we found was that the wives of soldiers who were deployed were more likely to have mental health diagnoses than wives of soldiers who were not deployed. And not only was it deployment versus non-deployment, but also the length of deployment that turned out to be a factor.
Mansfield studied the records of 250,000 Army wives who went to Army health clinics. But that means she wasn't able to measure women who had the same problems but didn't go see a doctor.
We already know that there's a stigma associated with seeking help for mental health problems in military personnel, that the wives may feel that way as well. For that reason, we actually believe that our estimates are conservative, that the problems might actually be greater than what we found in this study.
Army wife Kelly Lohman agrees there's a lot of stigma that keeps Army wives from getting care.
You're viewed as weaker or a complainer by other wives because everybody is in the same situation. All of our husbands are gone. When you hear one that is exceptionally loud about complaining of her two children or, you know, just things are so awful for her, you get very aggravated because you're in the same situation. But everybody deals with the situations differently.
The study of Army wives looked at medical records up to 2006. Since then, the Army's added dozens of therapists and even made counseling available by telephone. To reduce stigma, sometimes there's no record kept of who gets therapy. Free daycare is now available for stressed-out mothers whose husbands are at war. And the military has reduced the length of those deployments. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
And that's all for Your Health. Please join us again next week for more of the best from the Health Desk here at NPR. I'm Rebecca Davis. Thanks for listening.